We only have a week to cover a lot of interesting stuff, so I don't know. It's going to be a wild ride, and we have to figure out how to do it. So I wanted to sort of finish off the discussion of grand unification this time, and also how it links to a bunch of other themes that people have been interested in for the past several decades now, because it's kind of an interesting detective story where there's things go well, and then you have a lead, and it looks very promising, and then everything falls apart, and you have to find a new suspect, etc. So, So somehow the short summary of the course so far, it was that, you know, the Lagrangian of the standard model is some particular Yang-Mills theory, and it's defined by its gauge group, G, and the representation R of that gauge group. And, you know, one of the point of the last few lectures, one of the important things we'd like to know is where these basic, most basic bits of data come from, or we'd like to understand them better. This one looks a little bit weird. It's the product of three groups. This one, the representation looks really weird. We'd really like to understand where that's coming from. There's a bunch of patterns and strange numbers in there. And so the past few lectures were about the idea that if we embed G into a bigger group, G prime, with some associated representation R prime, that when R prime breaks down to G, when G prime breaks down to G, and correspondingly R prime breaks down to R, we saw that in the context of SU5, or Patti Salam, or in both cases, those could be embedded even arguably more beautifully in SO10, that we get a kind of nicer understanding. We seem to get from a more elegant starting point, we seem to be able to, in some sense, derive the gauge group and representation data of the standard model. And, you know, I always remember, again, I always like to mention this because it's somehow, yeah, it's always stuck with me. When I was in grad school, I listened to a lecture on grand unification by Ed Witten, and he had this quote, which I thought was good, which is that he said, I mean, you can agree with this or not, you'll make your own judgment, but he said, life is too short to work on models that assume this is a coincidence, which I thought was very precisely stated. Like, it's not impossible that this whole story is just a coincidence. But yeah, it's kind of well, I think it's well said. I kind of share the feeling personally that it's a good enough coincidence that it's worth not ignoring. Or if you work on a model that totally that is sort of incompatible with this having any good explanation, then that's likely a problem. But on the other hand, the question is, what is the physical interpretation of this hint, if it's something real? Then that's a lot less clear. And so there's been a sort of winding story about that that I want to try to quickly summarize here. So the first thing you might ask, I mean, the first thing people asked is, okay, it looks like from a group theory standpoint, this group and representation fit beautifully into this group and representation, whichever one that may be, whichever of our three favorite candidates that may be. But if there's really only one gauge coupling, then why is it that the gauge couplings we see in nature, G1, G2, G3, you know, question one is why are they all, they're all quite different. In particular, G3 is a lot bigger than G1 and G2. So why are they all different? And then also, you know, all of these models shared the property that they put leptons and quarks into the same irreducible representation of this group. You know, this was a series of irreducible representations, but There were irreducible representations of quarks. There were irreducible representations of leptons. They weren't in the same representation, so whatever gauge boson talked to that representation, it only mixed quarks with quarks and leptons with leptons. And so as a consequence, baryon number was conserved at the renormalizable level in the standard model. But here, any of the grand unified schemes that we talked about have the property that we put quarks and leptons together. So for example, in SU5, you know, we had a five-component vector, and the top two components were a lepton doublet, and the bottom three components were the right-handed down quark, or its antiparticle. And but that means that now, if we think of the SU5 gauge bosons acting on those are the generators of SU5 are traceless anti-Hermitian 5x5 matrices. So there are traceless anti-Hermitian 5x5 matrices that are off diagonal here. That'll have, you know, a component up here, and its complex and its minus its complex conjugate down here, and it'll mix quarks into leptons. So you'll have processes where, you know, a quark comes in, and then you emit one of these SU5 gauge bosons, and a lepton comes out. And so, in other words, you have baryon number violating processes, and so you expect to get, the reason that the proton doesn't decay. The proton is not the lightest particle on the standard model, but it can't decay to any of the lighter particles because it's forbidden by baryon number conservation. All of the lighter particles don't have baryon number one. You can't make a state with baryon number one out of lighter particles than the proton. Well, if baryon number conservation isn't protecting the proton, then it will decay, and in all of these models, it will decay. Okay, so why haven't we seen the proton decay? Those are the two basic questions, and those questions were immediately given a splashy, spectacular answer. The same year that the grand unified theories were discovered, there's this famous paper by Georgi, Quinn, and Weinberg, giving a very beautiful answer. So, to explain the answer, let's have a little digression here about where I show you or remind you about Ken Wilson's picture of what effective field theory is and what the renormalization group, how to interpret it. So Ken Wilson said, so what are effective field theory and the renormalization group really about? So we have our path integral that we, so one approach to quantum field theory is the path integral approach, where we're always taking the path integral over all the fields in the theory of e to the I action. Okay, and then usually in practice, at least in theoretical calculations, instead of calculating this, so here we're basically summing e to the I times the action of a field configuration phi, and this path integral is short for an infinite number of integrals over the value of phi at position x1, at position x2, et cetera. So it's this really continuously infinite measure where we're integrating over the value of phi at each point in space and time. So instead of working with this oscillatory integral, usually we Wick rotate to Euclidean signature, in which case we have a path integral like this that we're doing. And then Ken Wilson says, okay, let's also go to Fourier. Let's work in Fourier space. So instead of integrating d phi at position x1 and d phi at position x2, et cetera, over all positions in spacetime, instead let's integrate over all the Fourier amplitude of d phi at momentum 1 and d phi at momentum 2, et cetera. So we'll do it over an integral at all, over all field values at every point in momentum space. Okay. And then, okay, so then this path integral over the e to the minus the so-called bare action, usually that's not well defined. And so instead we always in practice work with we put some UV cutoff on this, we cut off this inter, we regulate the integral in some way. So let's just regulate it in momentum space. We'll do this path integral over all points in momentum space, but only up to some cutoff. We'll only do it for momenta that are less than or equal to some cutoff lambda. And let's call the action that then appears in that cutoff integral S sub lambda. And then Wilson says, okay, great. So we can just write this now as, we can just split, you know, just like if you have an integral of dx and dy, you can times e to the minus f of xy, you can do the y integral first and rewrite that as dx of e to the minus f of some new f twiddle, which is just a function of x, where in other words, e to the minus f twiddle of x is just defined to be the integral of dy times this thing. So similarly, he says, okay, great, let's just split this, you know, split up the integration measure, look at the, first we'll put all the p's up to some lower cutoff, lambda prime. And then we'll do the rest of the p's, the ones in between lambda prime and lambda. Okay, and let's just define, says, okay, great, let's just define this thing to be e to the minus s of lambda prime of phi. So this whole expression becomes integral over p squared up to the lower cutoff lambda prime of e to the minus s lambda prime of phi. So in other words, we've taken the same expression for z and we've written it in two different ways. First we do the path integral up to a higher cutoff of e to the minus some action s sub lambda, or which we now will call the effective action at scale lambda. Or alternatively, we can write the same path integral, the same expression, as an integral just up to a lower cutoff, lambda prime, of e to the minus a different function, the effective action at lambda prime. And then he shows, and you may have shown this in a QFT course, that, well, anyway, so the whole story of the renormalization group is how, as you change the cutoff lambda, how does this function morph into this function? And in particular, if we're talking about a renormalizable theory, let's just think about renormalizable theories for now, then what happens is that this function really looks like the same function as this one. All that's happened is that the couplings, the various coefficients that appear in the Lagrangian, their numerical values have changed. So in this one, let's say we have some couplings which we can call g sub lambda, and over here they've turned into new values. We have the same function, but there's some new values g of lambda prime appearing over here. And the renormalization group, another way, more specifically, is about how, as we change the value of lambda, how these couplings numerically flow into these couplings. And in particular, we define the so-called beta function. So for any coupling G, we can define the beta function of G to be lambda dG d lambda, or in other words, dG d log lambda, because d log lambda is d lambda over lambda, so that's just this. So in other words, the beta function of G is just saying, you know, how much does g change by when I change the cutoff by a factor of e, or in other words, when I change log lambda by 1. Okay, so, fine. So as we run and scale, the couplings in our theory change. And in particular, we're interested in this question about, you know, Quinn, Weinberg, and Georgi. We're interested in this question of why the three gauge couplings were different, if supposedly they're all unified into a single gauge coupling. So let's look at the beta functions for the gauge couplings. Is this middle one still broken? No. So the beta functions for the gauge couplings, I won't derive them, but you know, the beta function for the gauge coupling G has this famous form that at one loop, it is given, in other words, at leading order, it's given by some dimensionless constant B, which is specific to that gauge coupling and depends on how many fermions and scalar fields and vector fields couple to this gauge field. So anyway, there's some famous formula, and in what representations they live in. So there's some famous formula for that, but let me just gloss over that for a second. I'll come back in a moment. So it's some constant, and then it goes like g cubed over 16 pi squared. That's just a famous formula. And it's usually more convenient to define. So there's an expression like this for we have our three couplings in the standard model, g1, g2, and g3. And there's an expression like this for each of them. And each one has a different bi because it talks to a different number of fermions and scalars and vectors and living in different representations. Okay, so there's some number to be computed there. But anyway, let's first just stick with this guy. So for each coupling, for the ith coupling, we define the so-called fine structure constant associated with it. Okay, we just define that to be the coupling squared over 4 pi squared. No, sorry, over 4 pi. So its beta function. So if you just multiply by gi on both sides here, you'll see this thing just becomes alpha I squared. And then this thing is, if we multiply by gi, this becomes gi dgi d log lambda. That's 1/2 d gi squared d log lambda, which is 1 over 2 pi, which is 2 pi d alpha I d log lambda. In other words, which is just 2 pi times the beta function for alpha I. So, in other words, that's equal to bi. So, in other words, the beta function for alpha I, which again is defined as d alpha I d log lambda, is equal to bi over 2 pi times alpha I squared. And so if we just, we can rewrite this, we can, you know, multiply on both sides by log lambda, d log lambda, divide both sides by alpha I squared. So we have d alpha I squared, d alpha I over alpha I squared is equal to bi over 2 pi d log lambda I. Log lambda, sorry. And so now if we integrate this thing, we get the running lambda. So if we integrate this thing, we'll get, you know, minus 1 over alpha I here. And on this side, we'll just get this coefficient times log lambda. And then we're going to evaluate it between, you know, if we're doing some definite integral on both sides, we're going to do a definite integral between the electroweak scale, let's say the when lambda is equal to the mass of the Z boson, and then we'll let the upper end of the integral be arbitrary lambda, because we want to see how the coupling flows if we start at the electroweak scale and go up. Okay, so if you just do that integral and simplify it a little bit, we have that the inverse of the ith coupling at some scale lambda is equal to the value that that inverse coupling, inverse fine structure constant, had at the Z boson mass minus bi over 2 pi times the log of the ratio of lambda to the Z boson mass. Okay, so now I just want to quote, without derivation, a fact for you that you may have already derived in a QFT course, but in any case, I won't derive it right now, which is that, okay, so first of all, there's the experimental values for alpha I inverse at the Z boson mass, okay, so there's some particular, anyway, there's some particular numbers. So the values of the three fine structure constants, or one over those structure constants, at the electroweak scale are something like 59.2, 29.6, and 8.5. Okay. And then, so that's this in this equation. And then this coefficient, again, this is this dimensionless number that just depends on the number of different types of particles that each of these forces talks to. It turns out, again, let me just, for the purposes of telling the story here, let me just quote the answer, that B1 has some positive value, and B2 and B3 in the standard model are both negative. Okay, they're minus 19/6 and minus 7. Okay, and so now the key point is that if you plot, so now we have this constant measured, and we have this coefficient here, and so, and we know the mass of the Z boson, so we can make a plot of this quantity, alpha I inverse, as a function of log lambda here. You see it's just linear in log lambda. It's just a constant plus a term that's linear in log lambda. Let's say log lambda over n. Now, let's just say log lambda in units of, okay, let me actually write this as, for display purposes, log base 10 of lambda over a GeV. So here, let's say, is 10 to the 2. GeV is the mass of the Z boson. And 10 to the 3 is sort of the electroweak. 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 3 is the electroweak scale. And then, okay, let's say up here at 10 to the 20, 10 to the 19. So, sorry. Log base 10 of this, I'm sorry. Lambda is 10 to the 2 GeV at the electroweak scale, so log of that is 2. And then the lambda at the Planck scale is 10 to the 19 GeV, so log of that quantity base 10 is 19. And okay, so what we have here is that if we just plot these guys, alpha 3 is the strongest force, so alpha inverse is the weakest one. It's down at 8 here. And since its B is negative, this whole coefficient, when you include this minus sign, is, since B3 is negative 7, and we have a minus sign here, this thing, alpha inverse grows with scale, or in other words, the coupling actually gets weaker as you go to higher scales. That's so-called asymptotic freedom. Same thing with alpha 2. And then alpha 1 does the opposite. It strengthens with scale. And okay, so it does something like this. But In the 1970s, the error bars on these were rather fuzzy, and it looked like what these things were doing was, it looked like they were perfectly unifying. Okay, so it looked like at that time that what they did was they all unified at about lambda equals 10 to the 15 GeV. So people were really impressed by that answer because, okay, so it answers question one up there, why are G1, G2, and G3 all different? Well, they said, oh, well, it's just that, you know, just like at the electroweak scale, the Higgs boson obtains a VeV, and below that scale, we no longer see electroweak symmetry explicitly. We only see electromagnetism and the strong force. There's something analogous that happens. Up at the gut scale, some new scalar field, the scalar field that breaks grand unified symmetry, obtains a big VeV of order 10 to the 15 GeV. So above that scale, there's only one coupling. And so that's why we see all our three couplings unify up there. But below that scale, the symmetry is broken. It looks, from the standpoint of lower scales, like there's really three different gauge couplings and they all run apart from each other as we run them to lower and lower couplings. It also explains question two, why the proton doesn't decay. Because, okay, now the gauge bosons that would be responsible here, that X gauge boson, which would be responsible for letting a quark turn into a lepton, that's one of the gauge bosons that gets broken in the spontaneous symmetry breaking process. So by the Higgs mechanism, it obtains a huge mass up at the gut scale. And so now, whenever we have any diagram for proton decay will involve that quark turning into a lepton, and then our X boson here, virtual X boson, decaying into some other stuff. But so this diagram will always go at low energies, if this is the proton, if this is part of the proton decay diagram, well, we'll have the propagator for this X particle. That'll go at very low energies. That'll go as, you know, 1 minus 1 over the mass of this guy. And then when we take the amplitude, we'll have to square. I mean, that'll be the amplitude. When we square the amplitude to get the decay rate, we'll have to square that 1 over this very heavy mass squared. So we'll get 1 over the mass to the fourth. And then if we just want to roughly estimate this decay rate, again, I'm not going to calculate it properly, but the decay rate has to have units of energy. So currently we have 1 over energy to the fourth. So we have to get the right units here, we have to multiply by something like m proton to the fifth, the available phase space energy available for the decay. And so the point is, since mx is really huge, if mx is sufficiently huge here, since it's in the denominator, this decay rate, the proton decay rate, will be very tiny. And in fact, when you numerically check, if you ask in the 1970s, if you put in 10 to the 15 GeV here, the decay rate was indeed at this magical value. It was low enough that protons decayed slow enough that people wouldn't have seen them decay yet. But it was also not infinite, but this thing was also not infinitely small. It was high enough that it was feasible to go out and look for these for proton decay. And so people got very excited and they made proton decay measurements. They built big experiments to go look for proton decay. Okay, so that was the good news. So then came it's a roller coaster, this lecture. That was the good news. And then there came some bad news, a bunch of bad news all at once. Okay, so the bad news, there were three bits of bad news. being a little bit ahistorical here, but so first, they predicted proton decay. Well, they went out and looked for it, and they did not find it. Okay, so indeed to this day, they've never seen a proton decay, but in any case, it quickly, the non-detection of proton decay, even very quickly after the, even very soon after the prediction, was enough to rule out SU5 grain unification, and also the SO10 that breaks through SU5. Okay. Second, the experimental measurements of G1, G2, and G3, in other words, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3 at the Z boson mass. You know, as the 80s came along, people actually directly observed the Z boson and the W boson for the first time, and they were able to get very precise measurements of those, much more precise measurements of those three coupling constants. And with those much more precise measurements, they saw, oh, actually the three couplings don't actually meet. They miss by quite a significant margin. I mean, they, you know, roughly speaking, trend toward each other, but they miss. Okay, so couplings no longer unify. And then third, the hierarchy problem began to sink in. Okay, so it was always the case that Up till then, you know, it looked like there was one scale in particle physics, which was the electroweak scale. So the electroweak scale is something like 10 to the 2 or 3 GeV. And then it was always clear that that was stupendously small compared to the basic scale in quantum, apparent scale of quantum gravity, the Planck scale, the scale you can, the only scale you can make by putting together H bar C and G Newton. 10 to the 19 GeV, but you know, no one worried about that because, and it's still the case. I mean, the fact of the matter is that regardless of what you hear people say, you know, we know a hell of a lot less about what, we don't know anything experimentally about quantum gravity. We know a lot less about what, how to quantize gravity. And so, you know, maybe the hierarchy problem that you seem to see when you just treat the metric just like another quantum field, like all the other fields in nature, you know, maybe you just shouldn't be doing that. People could and did ignore that hierarchy problem. But then, once grand unification came along, well, the grand unified scale was almost as high, and now these really were, the whole idea was that these were exactly the same sort of theories, and that our electroweak symmetry breaking was just the next stage and of a completely analogous higher scale symmetry breaking. But then it was very hard to see how you could get such a large difference between these two mass scales. And in particular, it seems like when you're calculating the effective potential, the effective Lagrangian for any quantum field theory, and in particular, if calculating the effective potential for the Higgs, the calculation in normal quantum field theory involves, for example, if you want to calculate the quantum corrections to the term in the potential involving two Higgses, in other words, the m squared h dagger h term that we had in our Lagrangian, then you're supposed to look at diagrams like this that have two corresponding external lines that are H's. And so, you know, you get contributions here that from the fermions in the standard model, like the top quark, that are huge, seem to go as this diagram diverges as the square of the momentum cutoff. And so in effective field theory, you expect this coupling, m squared, to be of order, the cutoff scale on this theory, which, again, the whole idea of grand unification is that's supposed to be this grand unified theory sitting up there. that replaces the standard model after the couplings unify. So people began to appreciate that this was a seemed to be a big problem, that for some reason the mass of the Higgs was stupendously small compared with what effective field theory predicted.
So could you just explain that last point again? Why do you expect the mass squared to be ordered?
Well, I'm not going to, if you write down this diagram with, one way to say it is that if you write down this diagram with, if you just write down the diagram, don't do the integral, but just look at the dimensions of it, and you just redefine so that there's only dimensionless variables inside the integrand, and you pull out all the dimensionful couplings in front, the only dimensionful coupling that you end up pulling out, I mean, the largest dimensionful coupling you end up pulling out, the one that will dominate. So you end up finding that the diagram, first of all, it's supposed to give a thing with dimensions of m squared. And so, not unexpectedly, you end up getting, every integral you write down has dimensions of order lambda squared, has dimensions of order energy squared. And in particular, this diagram diverges, but then when you cut it off, when you say the momentum only goes up to some cutoff momentum lambda, then it's no longer equal to infinity, but by dimensional analysis, the leading term that you get is exactly the largest thing you can write down with dimensions of energy squared, which is the cutoff squared. So you end up getting this term that seems to go as the cutoff squared. Another way to say it is that one of the things that Wilson explained in this approach was that if you look at how the couplings here relate to the couplings there, that barring any special cancellations, that what you get that supposing you began with a renormalizable theory at the top scale with just dimensionless coefficients, let's say, and then you run it down and you calculate the corresponding coefficients over here, that if you have the coefficient, if you look in the lower energy theory, lower energy effective theory, at an operator with dimension I, then so this term has to have a coefficient in order to make the total dimension of the Lagrangian. If this has mass, if the operator has mass dimension I, or sorry, let me call it mass dimension delta, then the coefficient in front has to have mass dimension d minus delta, and that in practice, barring any special cancellations, what you get by dimensional analysis is that in the lower scale theory, what you get is the leading term is just some dimensionless order one thing times lambda to the d minus delta. And so in particular, if this is the Higgs quadratic h dagger h term, so that delta is 2, then I did this backwards. What did I do? I'm just going to set my d is the mass dimension of this operator. So sorry, this whole thing has mass dimension d minus delta. So I'm sorry. So in the denominator, it's delta minus d. So what I meant to say was that if this is h dagger h, which has mass dimension 2. And this is 2 minus the space-time dimension 4, which is minus 2. So this thing diverges. It's an example of a so-called relevant operator. Its coefficient just flows and gets bigger and bigger as you flow down to low energy scales. The non-renormalizable operators for which lambda appears as a positive power in the denominator. They get suppressed, they get smaller and smaller as you flow to low energies. Again, just on dimensional grounds, but the lower dimensional operators, the so-called relevant operators, they do the opposite. Their coefficient just grows and grows as you flow to low scales. And it's, again, it's the, in particular examples, one can see this with a particular values, but the more general point is that the effective field theorist is making is really just a is just about counting dimensions and dimensional analysis. That you use the bit, yeah. That the thing that you put here. What can I say to make that explanation better?
So what I'm confused about is how do you look at this one loop diagram and, you know, looking at the diagram, say that the mass of the Higgs then has to be on the cutoff. Is this
well, really the so there is this I probably shouldn't have actually said it that way, to be honest with you. That's the sort of standard cartoon picture that is drawn. And what I'm about to do is, I drew this because I'm about to draw the corresponding diagram that it cancels with in supersymmetry. But strictly speaking, if it was just this, you could say, oh well, I'm used to when I'm doing my normalization that I'll have some terms that diverge, and I'll just throw those away as part of my. Renormalization procedure. And so you might wonder, okay, well, so this technically when I regulate this thing, there's a piece that diverges as lambda squared, but why don't I just throw that away? And that's quite a reasonable objection. So the better answer is to actually show that as you run the beta functions to take the couplings in that theory, which let's say they were just imagine, for example, that you had a very easy to understand theory at that high scale, which let's say it just had dimensionless coefficients and they were all of order one or something like that. And then if you follow the beta functions down to low energies to find out what are the induced couplings in that low energy theory, then on dimensional grounds you end up finding that they go as lambda. There's always a term there that goes like lambda to some appropriate power to get the dimensions right. And so for these relevant operators, that ends up being a positive power of lambda, so they end up getting bigger and bigger in those scales. So indeed, you caught me in an attempted sleight of hand, which I'm going to continue with, though, because when I'm about to say what the rebounding good news was. Okay, so things were looking grim, and then in 1981 there was this paper by Dimopoulos Raby and Wilczek where they wanted to make the whole gut story supersymmetric. Okay, so every time you can take the standard model, and every time you have a certain field appearing in a certain irreducible representation of the great gauge group, you just promote that to a superfield living in that same irreducible representation of the gauge group. So that now, if it previously just contained a fermion field, it now contains a fermion field and a boson field, or vice versa. And again, you write down the most general Lagrangian now that is Lorentz invariant, gauge invariant, and now also supersymmetric. And so that in that way you get the so-called MSSM, the minimal supersymmetric standard model. And you can do the same thing with grand unification. You can take your favorite grand unified theory, SU5 or SO10, and every time you previously had a field that lived in a certain irreducible representation of it, you replace that by a superfield, and now your supersymmetric grand unified theory is just the theory that's invariant under all the usual symmetries and supersymmetry. And so they pointed out that when you wrote down a supersymmetric version of SU5 or SO10, and then now when it gets its BEV from at this high energy scale, it breaks down to the MSSM, that now some good things happen. So basically, first of all, the key point that they made was that these dimensionless coefficients B1, B2, and B3, which again depend precisely on how many bosons and fermions the three different gauge fields talk to, that changes now in the MSSM. So now we get new values here, 41 over 10. Minus 19 over 6. Oops, sorry. No, those are the standard model values. Thought those looked too familiar. Anyway, 33 over 5. I write this down just because I'm trying to make it easy for you to do something which I recommend, which is just to actually plug to sort of get the feeling, to get the thrill that they would have felt at the time. If you now take those same initial conditions for the alphas, the measured values, but now you plug in these new renormalization group coefficients, B1, into that, into our renormalization equations, you know, now it's really spectacular how neatly they unify. Okay, so now you get three guys, and they really do perfectly meet. So that was very striking, and furthermore, it moved the scale of grand unification up by a little bit more than an order of magnitude. So it moved it up to 10 to the 16 GeV, which suppressed the proton decay rate by the fourth power of that increase. So it suppressed the predicted proton decay rate low enough that this grand unification scheme was no longer ruled out by the non-detection of proton decay, and indeed, people are still actively looking for proton decay from these experiments, and then also so those were two reasons to be excited about this theory, and then the third reason was that you know now you end up getting an extra diagram here for every fermion here, there's a corresponding superpartner F twiddle here, and if you calculate both of these diagrams and assume that the mass of this guy is the same as the mass of this guy, which is what unbroken supersymmetry would demand, then it turns out these two diagrams exactly cancel each other famously, and then if supersymmetry is broken so that this guy has a slightly different mass than this, well, they still almost cancel. They cancel up to a correction. So in other words, the UV part of the UV divergence, the lambda squared part over here, and the lambda squared divergence over here, those still cancel. And so the next to leading thing is the term that goes like M sub F squared over here and M sub F twiddle squared over here, and so now the diagram just goes as the difference between those two mass squareds. And so as long as the supersymmetry breaking is down at the electroweak scale, the story went, so that this mass difference is of order the Higgs mass, then suddenly the Higgs mass doesn't get big quantum corrections in its effective potential. And supposedly that the idea was that gives a better explanation. It still doesn't explain why there is this huge difference between this scale and this scale, but according to many people in the community, it gave a more satisfactory explanation for why quantum corrections didn't just drive this thing back up to here. Now, I must say, I've never, well, anyway. I've never liked this explanation. But in any case, so this thing came along, the Suzy Guts came along, and they seemed to solve the proton decay problem. They seemed to make the couplings unify perfectly, which I must say I am very impressed by. And then supposedly it gave a better explanation for why the Higgs mass is so light relative to the gut scale. So people got excited again. And then to add to the story, so if you take the MSSM as I just naively described it a moment ago, you just take all of the fields in the standard model, turn them into superfields living with the same gauge representations, write down the most general renormalizable Lagrangian. Well, actually, now that Lagrangian violates baryon and lepton number like crazy, so it's actually ruled out. So to fix that problem, you have to invoke a new symmetry, a Z2 symmetry called R parity. Okay, which is basically some symmetry under which the normal particles of the standard model have one parity and the superpartners have the opposite parity. And so as a consequence, it turns out that you can't write down the baryon and lepton number violating terms get eliminated. And so on the one hand, it sounds bad that you have to start making up new symmetries to rescue the theory right from the get-go, but on the good news is that this same symmetry turns out to stabilize the lightest supersymmetric particle. In other words, so there's some lightest supersymmetric part, some lightest superparticle of the known field, some lightest field with R parity minus one. And so it can't decay because it has to decay into a state with at least one, this is a multiplicative quantum number, so it has to decay into at least one other particle with parity minus one, because if it decayed into particles that just had parity plus one, then plus one times plus one times plus one is plus one. So this parity would be violated. So it makes the lightest negatively charged R parity particle stable. And the idea is, oh great, that could be the lightest supersymmetric particle becomes a good dark matter candidate. And in fact, if it's down at this, if the lightest supersymmetric particle, by this argument over here, we wanted the supersymmetric particles to be not very different in mass from the ordinary particles in the standard model. And it turns out that in the early universe, that if you have heavy particles at roughly a GeV scale, if you have heavy particles that have roughly a GeV in mass, and here this is very rough. This can be an order of magnitude up or down, several orders of magnitude up or down. So it's actually, if you have guys roughly of that mass, and coupling to the rest of the universe with weak strength, then if the lightest superpartner, in other words, is one of those, is one of the not colored but merely weak charged particles in the supersymmetric sector, then it turns out that as the universe cools down, it ends up with a relic abundance which can be in the ballpark for what you need to explain the dark matter today. So this always had a name that was too exciting. It was always called the WIMP miracle, which makes it sound like a very, like something really worked out great, like some puzzle pieces really fit together beautifully. Now that's okay. You can call something like this a miracle because here you really change these values to a new set of sharp predictions and things meet beautifully. Here it's a very fuzzy thing. I mean this prediction of the fact that a particle in this range and with weak interactions gives roughly the right dark matter. abundance, that's a prediction with orders of magnitude of slop in it. So it gives the right ballpark in a very, if you have a very low standards for what right is. But anyway, which is good, but it's just not, miracle sounds too good. But anyway, so people were excited about that. And then also also in the early 80s, another thing happened to drum up people's excitement, which was that inflation was invented. So, and inflation was claimed to solve the puzzles of why the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. Where the spectrum of primordial perturbations came from, primordial density perturbations. And it was also proposed as a solution to the monopole problem, okay? So this is something I haven't mentioned yet, but it turns out that when you have a unified gauge group that breaks down to the standard model gauge group, because the U1 in the standard model was ultimately contained inside that bigger compact gauge group, it means that U1 is compact. It ends up meaning that grand unified theories predict magnetic monopoles. So in particular, as the universe cools down, let's say we started up here at the Planck scale, but then at some moment when the temperature got to the gut scale, 10 to the 16 GeV, some grand unified Higgs boson got a VeV all of a sudden and broke the grand unified symmetry down to the electroweak symmetry, then at that moment you would predict roughly one. There's a famous paper in the late 70s by John Preskill pointing this out. You predict one magnetic monopole roughly forming per Hubble volume at that time, but the Hubble volumes at that time were much smaller in co-moving size than Hubble volumes today. So if you get one monopole per Hubble volume back then, and then you follow it to today there's tons and tons of those Hubble volumes contained within our current Hubble volume. Or in other words, you predict quite a high density of magnetic monopoles in the universe today, and we don't see that. Okay, so inflation, one of the, this was a problem caused by grand unified theories interpreted in the cosmology at that time. In the cosmology at that time, people thought there was just radiation domination all the way back to the Big Bang. But in that case, you predict too many magnetic monopoles. So one of the key ideas about inflation was that it was supposed to stretch the universe out very fast and dilute these monopoles today. So it does a very good job of that. It also does a very interesting, although non-specific job of this, and then it's more controversial whether how well it does or does not do that. So suffice it to say that the point that I wanted to make was that this is another model that came along around 1980, captivated much of the high energy community. And in particular, the simplest models of inflation, the models with just a single scalar field, the models that really got people excited were, you could write down models that just involved a single new field, the inflaton, and with a very simple potential like m squared phi squared, or that would be enough to do the trick, or lambda phi to the fourth, very simple things like that. And those models, it turns out that because the predicted power spectrum of primordial density perturbations, primordial scalar perturbations, goes like 1 over the slow roll parameter times the potential during inflation over the Planck mass to the fourth. But then this is a measured number. This is equal to about 10 to the minus 9. That it turns out that in the simplest models of inflation, epsilon is not very small. In all of these simple models, epsilon is of order 1 over the number of e-folds of inflation. So it's something like 1/10 or 1/160th or something like that. So anyway, in all of these simple models, the prediction is that V, the potential during inflation is about the gut scale. Okay, so everything seemed to be pointing. All of these pieces, all of these puzzle pieces all seem to be fitting together. Many, a vast majority of the in the high energy community became convinced starting in the 80s and then proceeding up until very recently that something like this picture was right. That they were basically supersymmetric grand unified theories that were somehow related to inflation, that maybe inflation took place somehow related to the symmetry breaking process, the symmetry breaking phase transition that broke grand unification down to the standard model, and that gave you a nice dark matter candidate, solved the monopole problem, etc. So it seemed to have a lot of good things going for it. And so just to say quickly, unfortunately we're gonna, so, you know, then there's been bad news for that idea over the past couple, over the past decade or so. So, you know, the first thing is that this has been creeping up, but it's become especially clear with the turning on of the LHC that it looks like there are no super partners. At the electroweak scale. Okay, that could still be wrong. There's still the minimal supersymmetric standard model by itself has a lot more free parameters than the standard model, and then people also consider extensions of it. They consider less minimal versions of the minimal analogs of the minimal supersymmetric standard model with more particles and more free parameters but that still solve the hierarchy problem in the way that supersymmetry does. And so it is possible still to wiggle around and still solve the hierarchy problem to some extent while still having superpartners at a low enough scale that we could detect them soon or that they're still at low energies. But I personally wouldn't bet on that, and I think that doesn't seem to be the natural reading of the results at the moment. So it looks a hell of a lot like there are no supersymmetric particles at the electroweak scale. Also, there's kind of a similar story with the predicted dark matter here. If the dark matter is a supersymmetric partner at roughly this scale, then there's an exciting thing about that was that made it something you could look for and hope to detect in underground searches, and people have been doing that now for decades, and those have not been detected, and the parameter space has been, you know, the parameter space that looked most natural at the beginning, it's quite an analogous situation here. The parameter space that looked natural at the beginning has been largely ruled out. There's a lot of parameters and a lot of, and especially if you allow yourself the freedom to go beyond the MSSM, there's a lot of room to wiggle and say maybe this candidate is still there. But I personally wouldn't bet on that either. So you know, the other thing that happened was just that I covered it up, but I was saying that inflation predicted the simplest models of inflation. Took place at the gut scale, but then those predict a detectably large amount of those predict that the primordial tensor power spectrum, the primordial gravitational waves, should go as so instead of the scalars, which went as 1/2 epsilon times the ratio of the potential to the Planck mass to the fourth, the tensors go as just a factor of 8 in place of 1/2 epsilon. So suffice it to say that once you know this is the gut scale, you have a predicted size for the tensor for the primordial gravitational waves, and again those two have been ruled out. So the simplest models of inflation that got people excited originally were subsequently ruled out in recent in the past 10 years or so. So you know, a lot of the clues that got people very excited didn't pan out, and it looks like that whole picture, that even no matter how compelling it looked, is probably not right. Now, just to say that there's a couple of important subsequent pieces of there's a couple of new ingredients that suggest an alternative picture. Well, let me continue next time. I'm going too long. Also, that's a good place to stop. You know, there was this exciting picture about how grand unification. Well, there's been this roller coaster, and ever since the 80s, there were a number of hints that suggested to people that the Susie Gutt picture was on the right path. Susie Gutt coupled with inflation, and then that's taken a number of hits in recent years. Although I should also add that inflation also made some other successful predictions about the primordial scalar perturbations, so that has, in a sense, taken a mixed dosage of hits and positive encouragement. Anyway, so, but the roller coaster continues. I'll discuss some other hints that I didn't get a chance to at the beginning of the next lecture.